Thanks to all who are joining our event this afternoon, this evening, late at night, depending where you're calling in from. We are very honored to be presenting this beautiful book, Map of Hope and Sorrow, to our Kanios community, subtitled Stories of Refugees Trapped in Greece. This is a profoundly important and urgent book that I hope each of you will come directly to the bookshop to collect your copy. The story details refugee testimonies. These are people trapped in refugee camps in Greece. The book includes a historical context to really broaden our understanding of how and why this crisis is upon us. And as well, the book includes ways that we can participate in helping to rectify the situation and righting some of the injustices that are being perpetrated right now in Europe, and alleviate some of the suffering that is taking place as we speak. Our two esteemed guests, Helen Benedict and Iyad Awadnan, have co-authored the book, and each will be discussing with you some of the key points and details. I'd like to give you just a little bit of background. Helen Benedict is a recipient of the 2021 Penn Jean Stein Grant for Literary Oral History and the Otto B. Wells Award for Bravery in Journalism. She's author of 13 books, that's novels as well as nonfiction, including the award-winning A Lonely Soldier, The Private War of Women Serving in Iraq, and a play entitled The Lonely Soldier Monologues. Helen's writing has inspired both a class action suit against the Pentagon on behalf of people sexually assaulted in the military, and in 2012, the Oscar-nominated documentary, The Invisible War. She's a novelist and professor of journalism at Columbia University. We look forward to her forthcoming novel I just learned about, The Good Deed, which has to do with the topic of our evening. Working with Helen closely and joining us tonight from Reykjavik, we welcome Iyad Awadnan, formerly a law student from Damascus, Syria. He is a writer and poet, currently living as an asylum seeker in Reykjavik. During his 4 years in Greece, Iyad has worked as a cultural mediator, translator, and interpreter for various NGOs. He has published a featured article in Slate magazine detailing his escape from Syria. So we are very honored and pleased to welcome both of you and our Kanios community. If you all would now give a warm Zoom welcome to our guests, and we'll proceed to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks very much. And hi, Ellie. I see, I can see some of your names on the screen, which is great. And so a friend of mine is here. Nice to see her.
Hello, everyone. I'm so pleased to be here with you, and I hope you enjoy our discussion about the book.
Yes. Shall we begin?
I think, yeah, why not?
Okay. So what I'd like to do at the beginning is explain a little bit about the setup of the book, and I'll read a tiny bit of it to set the scene for everybody, and then Ian and I will plunge in and talk until it's time for questions. So please, and we love questions, so please store them up, and we'll be happy to do them. So Iyad wrote the preface, which you want to explain a little bit about what that is?
It was like a piece when I was detailing my journey from Syria to Greece, like detailing everything. And one of my friend who is a lawyer thought that this would be a good piece for my case as asylum seeker in Greece. So that was it. It was about my journey and the same thing about the life conditions somehow in the camp.
Right. And yeah, gave that when we first met, and we'll talk a bit about how that happened in a little while, but not long after we met, he gave the manuscript of this piece to me just so that I could have a look at it and see how the English translation was. And I read it and I was so moved by it, and I realized how beautifully it was written. And I realized that I had stumbled across a true writer. So I asked his permission to polish it up just a teeny bit more and send it around for publication. And Slate Magazine took it and published it as their cover story, which was very exciting. It all happened quite fast as well. So that, in a way, we didn't know it yet, but that was sort of the birth of the book. So after, the preface, I write an introduction, and that's what I'm going to read a little bit from, just to give you an idea of why the book is set in Greece and how we go about it. The introduction is called Hope and Sorrow. This is my friend Hassan. He is a man without hope. These were the words that Iyad Awadonan used to introduce his fellow Syrian to me when we met in 2018. The three of us were standing inside a foul-smelling, overcrowded refugee camp, surrounded by tents, rubbish, and flies, while a police officer eyed us suspiciously from inside his guard booth. Hassan knew little English at the time, and I do not speak Arabic, so Iyad translated. I turned to squint at Hassan through the sun. It was June and Greek Island hot, and I had just failed to find a working toilet or running water, the camp supply having been cut to 2 hours a day. He gazed back at me shyly, a slight man of medium height, with a gaunt face, dramatic black eyebrows, a crooked nose, and a bold streak of white through his black hair. His smile seemed kind, but his brow was lined and his mouth pinched, so I took him for more than 40. He was, I later found out, 25. "Shall we go somewhere private to talk?" I asked, curious to hear what had robbed him of hope. "Yes, follow us, please," Iyad replied for him, and led us up the scrubby mountainside above the camp to the spot where he and his family had slept during their first weeks on the island. There we sat on a fallen log in the shade of an ancient olive tree, encircled by clumps of brittle yellow grass and litter, and gazed out at the sea. One of the many ironies that comes from installing a hideous refugee camp on a beautiful island like Samos is that from every angle the camp looks over a view fit for the gods. The northern Aegean stretches in its glittering turquoises and blues all the way to the sky. The town of Vathi lies like a tumble of sugar cubes at the bottom of the hill below the camp, and the lavender mountains of Turkey rise in the near distance, the very Anatolian range under which Homer had Odysseus glimpse the tortures of Tantalus. It is hard to escape the thought that refugees on Samos suffer a similar fate, taunted wherever they turn by a horizon that promises distant lands they may never see, a beauty they lack the peace of mind to appreciate, and a freedom they fear they will never find. Iyad Hassan and the other refugees on Samos and in this book embody an enormous change in modern history. Not only are there some 84 million forcibly displaced people in the world, more than at any time since World War II, and millions more since Putin invaded Ukraine, but they are fleeing a combination of war, civil unrest, religious conflict, poverty, persecution, local violence, and global warming, forces often inextricably intertwined, just at a point when authoritarian governments are rising all over the world and anti-immigrant sentiment is rising with them. As a result, many refugees are being persecuted, demonized, and denied their legal rights, not only by those authoritarian nations, but within Europe, Britain, Australia, and the United States too, the very democracies that are supposed to protect them and that in some cases turned them into refugees in the first place. The US's war on terror alone has displaced more than 37 million people since 2001. Some of the worst of this persecution is being played out in Greece. So that explains kind of why we focused on Greece, because it is the main gateway to Europe, and also because in 2016, the EU made a deal with Greece and Turkey to basically trap anybody coming from the Middle East and Africa there and stop them coming to Western Europe. And that's why we have the subtitle Trapped in Greece. And they did the trapping partly through mostly through bureaucratic slowdowns that just meant that people, once they arrived, couldn't leave for years and years.
I think I would like to start, like, what was the reason that brought me to Greece in the first place? And the same thing about Helen too.
Yeah.
I would say, like, I'm sure for the last 11 years, you have heard a lot of news about the Syrian revolution. So I would say that the first reason that I left Syria was because of the war and because there is no safety anymore. I was a student in Syria. I was like studying for 2 years out of four in the law school, but I couldn't finish. Like, even though I was living like around Damascus, so we moved from an area to another, just hoping that one day everything will become the same, safe, but no. So we left to Idlib in the north of Syria, and kind of it is the same. There you were controlled by the government, and you are able to see everything bad, and the same thing also in Idlib. After that, like, the life was really hard. Like, you are not safe at all. You will be stopped by anyone who has gone. So we left to Turkey. From Turkey, we stayed there for a year and a half. Like, maybe a lot of Syrian or a lot of people there, they will say the life is hard. And this is not just, it is not enough to say the life is hard, because you need to explain why you cannot stay there. The first thing, I stayed working for a year and a half. I have never seen a contract that guarantee my right if something bad happened to me while I am working. The same thing, I'm not allowed to work. Even like, you are not allowed by law to be recognized as a refugee. Like, we were known there as a guest. A lot of people, they think that we are cowards and we are coming there just to hide behind their backs. We tried to explain a lot of times that this war is something awful, because your enemy is yourself. You are either fighting your friend, your cousin, and someone you know. So after a year and a half, we took the boat. 67 people, including my family and I. Small boat, 9 meters. This is the length of it. And we crossed the sea because we believed that we will find the safety and dignity in Europe. At least maybe to achieve some of goals, because a lot of us were in schools and had dreams for their lives. That was the reason I went to Greece.
And then what happens, part of the this EU-Turkey deal I mentioned, is that once that was instituted, every asylum seeker had to go through two interviews. And the first interview was they had to prove that it's not safe to be sent back to Turkey. Because one of the reasons, the rationales behind this this deal was that Turkey was what is legally called a safe third country. In other words, people could be sent back there safely. But as he had just said, Turkey does not recognize the rights of refugees, does not recognize Syrians, for example, as refugees at all. Nor has it, when it finally signed the Geneva Refugee Convention document that grants international rights to refugees to seek asylum and to not be persecuted, it did not sign the part that agreed not to commit refoulement, which is what this wonderful French word, which means sending people back to the country that they fled, where they will probably be killed. Turkey, I don't think many people in the, you know, in America know this, but Turkey never agreed to that, to not commit refoulement. So it means that if you flee to Turkey from Afghanistan or Syria or many other countries at war, it can send you right back there, even though death awaits you in that place, which is, you know, against international law all over the rest of the West. So it is not a safe country, and this has been pointed out many, many times, and yet Greece to this day continues to insist that it is. So that's the first way people get trapped. And then they have to wait, if they pass that interview and they don't get deported, then they have to wait for the second interview, which is the actual asylum interview, where the judges decide whether to grant you official refugee status. And that can be a wait of years between the two interviews, years and years. And meanwhile, you're living in a camp. You want to talk a bit about what that's like?
So after my first interview, and this is the registration interview, it was like, as Helen mentioned, it is about Turkey, whether Turkey is a safe country for you or not. So until that time, the life was, you are surrounded by nothing except like, you will see fence, policemen, everything. Like you are stuck in a camp where you can do nothing except waiting. One day I was like in the downtown, in a stationery shop. And then I saw Helen for the first time. She invited me for a cafe, like she just came and she was talking to the owner. It was really nice moment, because normal, like when you are surrounded there on the island, okay, in the beginning, when the people start moving to Europe or traveling to Europe, the local people, they were really nice. They were like smiling and helping. But with the time when a camp, this camp was built for 600 person only, but at the time it was over 3,000. So imagine what will happen to you if you have this place in your beautiful island. So you will see that a lot of faces are angry. And that was when I saw Helen. Like, it was really nice for me, because a lot of time you see a lot of people angry at you or looking at you with anger.
I just went up. So this was my second day in Samos, and I went there because I knew what was going on. All the other journalists were going to the island of Lesbos, which was more famous, with a more famous refugee camp. But I knew there was one that was just as bad in Samos that nobody was paying attention to. So I went to that one to see how it was. This was 2018. My second day, I walked into this shop to buy a map, and I saw Iyad there asking for something in English. So I just, accosted you and asked and invited you for coffee. I forgot to explain why or who I was. But then eventually I did. And Iyad couldn't meet me then, but we agreed to meet up the next day. And that's the scene I just read, where we met when I was actually in the camp waiting to meet the manager for an official tour of the camp, which I never got, and it never happened. She stood me up. But that's how we met. And we hit it off and we went up the mountain and we started talking to Hassan. And I very shortly after, then we kept meeting day after day, and Iyad would bring me more people who wanted to talk to me. And what I was asking about was what it was like to live in the camp from day to day. How do people survive there? Because I was working on the novel that Marianne just mentioned, The Good Deed, and I wanted a flavor of, and I really wanted to know, how do you survive in a place like that? Because it was really awful. Not only was it stuck, it was behind, you know, the fences and barbed wire and concrete walls with metal shipping containers that people lived in, crowded together on bunk beds. But between the containers were thousands and thousands of tents just crammed in everywhere, spilling out all over the hill, piles of litter, rats running around, broken porta potties, stench of sewage. It was what I call like a slum inside a prison, is what it looked like. So I wanted to know how people survive from day to day. And a lot of people wanted to talk about that, because that is, this is not what they had expected from Europe. And it's shocking. Right.
That's the thing. Like, I have a lot of friends, and a lot of them, they just wanted to talk about what they are facing and what they are feeling. So they were really, I don't know if this is the right word, excited, but they want the world to know what is happening. And we think and that the best thing is through writing. So we were meeting with Helen, we were telling about everything. A lot of them, like, they wanted to show that this is what means to be asylum seeker in Greece.
Yeah.
With the time we were spending hours and hours talking. So you can say that it was articles in the beginning. About the book itself, it did not happen by sudden.
Right.
There was like a lot of time, you know, like in 2020, the idea was Helen to visit Greece and then we will go to a camp in north or west, Yanana. Like, yeah. This camp, no one has said anything about it before. It is like close to the border with Albania, I guess.
Yeah, and we were also going to head up towards Macedonia. In other words, we wanted to talk to people who were living in these really remote camps, because what the Greek government was doing was sending people out of sight as far as they could, out, you know, with the kind of out of sight, out of mind philosophy. We don't want to see refugees, so we'll send them to these really remote, cold corners. But that was March 2020, and you all know what happened in March 2020. So there was I packed, all ready to go, meet up with Iyad, do this work. And I couldn't go because the lockdown started happening. And even if I'd gotten there, I wouldn't have been able to get back. So that's when we had the idea that Iyad was in Greece already. I already knew he was a great interviewer because I'd seen the way people open up to him in our talks when we'd met up. And I knew he was a really good writer too. So I just thought, why not be co-authors? And Iyad could interview people, Arabic speakers in Greece in person when he could through COVID. And I would interview people who spoke English or French over WhatsApp who were still trapped in camps until I could go back. So that's sort of what it took us through the worst years of COVID, which was really actually lucky in a way, because we both had a lot to do, and the people we talked to had quite a lot of time on their hands because they couldn't go anywhere. And as we mentioned, it's almost impossible to find a job or do anything. It is impossible to go to school. So the people we found were willing to spend a lot of time telling our stories. You know, I was thinking, Iyad, when you were saying about how we felt it was really important to kind of push back against the outrage of this situation by writing,
Yes.
Ida B. Wells, who was this really famous and important early journalist in America, an African American journalist, she said something like, this will be a paraphrase, but something like, the first act of resistance is to tell stories. And I think that it's perfect, isn't it? And it's exactly the way everybody in the book felt about why they wanted to be in the book and why they wanted to tell us their stories. It was their act of resistance.
And the other thing also, it is not just about their time as a refugee. We wanted to tell the whole story, just to to tell people that our life did not start near the border of Europe. Before Europe, we had like life. Yes, it might be not rosy for all of us, but at the same time, we had a beautiful life. We had this sense of belong to a place where you know that you are able to do something.
Yeah.
You can like achieve your goals, or at least you can continue your study.
Right. So each person, because we felt it was really important not to do what journalists usually do and just pigeonhole people into the big moment of trauma in their life, survivor, refugee, you know, that kind of thing, was we wanted to open it up, as Iyad just explained. Each person has three chapters. The first is their life at home, their childhood memories, their family lives, you know, what was going on in their love lives, and you know, the things that concern us all, and up until the moment they were forced to leave. Their second chapter is the journey, the flight, some of which are astonishing what people endure and what they can endure to survive and to help their children survive. And the third chapter for each one person is what happened to them once they reached Greece. So that's the pattern of the book. That's why we only feature five people, because each of them has three chapters, and any more than that, the book would have been unmanageably long.
Yeah, and there is something important about this book. And I would say that this is the idea of Helen in the first place. Because Helen used to see that a lot of people write the stories for others. They tell the story. But for us, we wanted this book to be in their own words, in the people's own words, like oral history. Because somehow we find that stories come closer to readers if they were coming from the person itself. I would say when I know that I am the one who controls the story, I will leave the part that I feel embarrassed or I don't like. Like there is no pressure on me to tell what.
Yes, exactly. Because we were very aware of how often people who are living on the edge who have been through horror are exploited by journalists. And we didn't want to do that at all. And I especially felt that as a Western white woman. So getting off the page and so people could use their own words was really important to us. So this is an unusual book because it's like a mix of narrative journalism when in both our voices we set the scenes, describe people, explain what was going on politically and so on, and oral history. Then we, you know, we leave and then it's the oral histories. Of course, we edited them and got them into order and everything because people don't always tell their stories in, you know, in perfect form. But that meant a lot to the people in the book too, right? Because too often, when they go through asylum interviews and they talk to border patrol people and the police, nobody's listening to them with any kind of respect. It's all about trying to catch you out lying. So to be listened to with, you know, without judgment and with respect, and to have your own words be the most important thing, I think was a relief to a lot of people because it had been too long since anyone had listened to them like that, at least anyone from the outside. Would you agree with that? Yeah.
I do. Like when I have, look, when I control the story, I feel that I have my dignity.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the important thing. Because a lot of times you feel that your dignity has been taken away from you. For example, in the interview, as you mentioned, that they will ask you about details that you don't want even to remember.
Right. And it can be really traumatizing and invasive. It's just it dehumanizing, all those things. We didn't want to do any of that. So nobody's in the book who didn't really want to be in the book. That's the other important thing. And there were some people who dropped out, you know, and said, no, I can't do this. It's too hard to tell my story. It's too painful. Or I'm afraid that even if you disguise my name, my origins, my family at home will be put in danger by this one person left because of that. So we did interview quite a few people who never made it into the book too. And that was sad because we wanted to include more, but we just couldn't.
I think also there is like two reasons for this book, emotional and the reason as a political. I would say like, since I spent many years traveling from a camp to another, like I wanted to change this way that a lot of people look at us as asylum seeker or refugee, that we are here to steal the land or to change the culture or maybe to destroy something. They always like had this idea that they are stranger, they don't belong to here. So this book is kind of our final way to say that we are the same. I think we are the same, or what?
Yes, that we're all, that we have, as human beings, we have so much more in common than we have different.
Exactly.
Than we are different. This is something I feel I rely on a lot as a novelist, so that I can write about people who have different lives than me, or make up people. And also as a journalist, you find all the things you have in common that you can connect, even sometimes without language, whether it's over children or food or a piece of clothing or something pretty or a joke. You know, when one of Iyad's chapters is about a woman called Asmahan, who's also Syrian, whom he was in a camp with and was friends with before, long time before we even thought of this book. But, you know, sometimes I would join in over WhatsApp to talk to her too. And, you know, she and I couldn't speak together directly because of the language barrier, but we were always laughing. So, you know, we could communicate in other ways. And I just think people forget that, you know. Just today, I was reading rhetoric, of course, former President Trump on his endless campaign to become president again, is saying those exact things about people that you just quoted, you know, people coming over the border to change us, to change our culture. The new government in Sweden, which is very right wing, used that same trope to argue against allowing refugees and immigrants into their country. They're coming to change our culture. They're coming to replace us. It's a white supremacist trope. Let's just call it by what it is. A white Christian supremacist trope. And it's something that's got to be pushed back against at every opportunity. So,
if you don't mind, just a brief interjection and praise of these interviews. The fact that you did include in painstaking and respectful and careful detail the person's life before they were forced to leave. You know, I'll just say from my perspective here, at such a distance, you hear the word refugee, and it's such a label you have a set of assumptions about it. Here, you break this down to show in daily rhythms of work, of family life, of hopes, dreams, whatever it might be, the individual lives of people before any notion of having to flee for their own safety and well-being, or the safety and well-being of their family. The interviews are so detailed, and I know that hours and hours of time went into, in some case, daily, you know, video calls. I'm just so impressed and amazed with the dedication that must have been there on both sides, from you all as interviewers and then those who gave you their story. Again, with delicate details, and the subject is in control of those details, but we get the fullest three-dimensional experience of the human struggle that this book does touch on, as Iyad, you said, both the emotional and the political. And we have such a political rhetoric to filter through, but you have given us the humanity, the human story. Okay, I'm sorry to interject, but I just want to applaud both of you for that work just in this section. So please continue, and excuse me.
No, that's all right. Well, thank you. Maybe we could talk a little bit about the people in the book and how the interviewing went with them. You want to talk about Asmahan a bit? Yeah.
You know, like the first time, my first year was in a camp in Samos Island. And after that, I have been transferred to the north of Greece, Thessaloniki, near Kavala, where was the first time I met Asmahan. Asmahan and I, like, for the first time, we met as a Syrian, just so we have the same language and we were talking. But with the time, our relationship gets stronger and stronger, like for hours and hours. The only thing we were doing is sitting either outside the container or inside. And a lot of details you will see in the book. And we were like talking about memories, thinking like about sad memories or happy memories. So we were talking about everything. And as Helen mentioned before, like, there are a lot of people who wanted to be in the book, but we could not. Otherwise, it will be really a huge book. Some of them, we touched their passion and their like desire to let the others know what is going. And just like they want, even, for example, a lot of subjects are forbidden to say, let's say. It is like not usual to talk about, especially like from the women's side. But Asmahan, she wanted to talk about everything. She wanted to fight against this. So you will find a strong, brave woman.
Yeah. Who is so open, so extraordinarily open. It's really unusual.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Helen like met her through the phone, and you know the way she speaks, like she did not finish her school, but she has her way of telling as a poet, like something really beautiful.
She's got a very poetic way of expressing herself. It's really very beautiful. It's true. She
stood for me because of that. Like Asmahan was one of the people in the book. Also for the others too.
Yeah, everybody has their own poetry in their voices as well. I think you'll feel that when you read it. There's a lot of lyricism and rich imagery that people just use naturally. Even people, you know, even the English speakers were speaking English as a second or third language, but they still have that poetry. So the first person in the book is actually Hassan, who I read to you about, who was Iyad's friend, and we met up on the mountain that first day. And he loves social media. So as well as talking to me for hours and hours, he would often compose these long, 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 long texts, or leave me long recordings on WhatsApp when it was of a 7-hour time difference between New York and Greece. You know, we would often be on quite different times, but he stayed up very late, and most of the night, I think he would, and he would write me these long things, adding to the story or recalling memories that had come up to him as he thought over our conversation for that day. So those texts, and those are very much in his own words, of course, that's woven through his story. And then there is Evans, a young Nigerian man I met. He was 22 and I met him on Samos more recently. But I started off during COVID interviewing him on WhatsApp before I ever met him in person. He's gay, and he had to flee homophobic laws and really hate-filled culture towards LGBTQ people in Nigeria. So that his story is also about the plight that LGBTQ refugees face, some of the unique challenges and difficulties they face in camps. And he also, when I finally met him, he really needed to talk, but he said this beautiful thing once. He said, I said, I'm really sorry if this, because sometimes he'd get very upset. His story is really hard, as you will see. And I would say, if it's too painful, we can stop. And he said once, I'm torn between the pain of telling and the pain of not telling. So he said, I need to tell this story, but he couldn't always do it every time we met. And sometimes when I finally went there in person in the summer of 2021, went back to Samos, we would take these long walks. He's very athletic, and we'd take these long walks up and down the hills of Samos. And as we talked and walked, often his stories would come out then more than when I was sitting down with the tape recorder. So I'd have to like rush madly home and write them all down before I forgot. And then there's Marsal, a young Afghan girl who's 21 when I met her in the summer of 2021. She's the most recent one I met. And she, during her flight with her family from Afghanistan, fleeing the persecution of the Taliban, she kept a diary the whole time in English to keep up her English. She was a very good student at school. So she gave me her diary, and I asked her if I could incorporate some of that in with her story, with our interviews. So she partly spoke and partly wrote herself, her chapter. And then the last one is Calvin. Calvin is the only one, he's from Cameroon, a political refugee. He's the only one I never actually met in person. Our entire relationship was conducted through the tiny square, of the telephone, which was not easy. But and he was writing a whole novel on his phone with his thumb while he was stuck at the camp. And he was a remarkable person too, as you will see when you read it. So those are the five people in the book.
And there is a whole chapter also about women.
Right. Yeah.
And somewhat, because it is a nightmare to be a woman there.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I felt it was important to have a separate chapter focusing on the plight of women. So in that chapter, there are lots of women from different countries who I met and, who were more briefly interviewed. So it's a different shape than the others, but it's sort of in the middle of a book, yeah.
Helen,
Sorry.
Please, go ahead.
Would like to say, in this book, you won't only see problems like the refugee crisis, and no, you are also going to see solution based on experts about what can we do.
Yeah,
that's a critical part of the book, indeed. I'm sorry, just to interject, may I suggest, would you care to read a short excerpt from one of the testimonies? I think that people
Yes.
might like to just get a feeling of that, and then perhaps after we might open for some questions from the group.
Love to. Yes, because there is a reason. We don't want to make this book sound too grim, and there is a reason it's called Map of Hope and Sorrow, because there is humor and hope in it too. So I'll read, speaking of Marcel, the young Afghan woman I mentioned, I'll read a little bit from her piece, which is addressed to all of us. Do you know about refugees' dreams? If our country was at peace, we would never leave. No one wishes to live in a tent or a camp. Everyone loves their home. Unfortunately, the Taliban came to our city and started fighting. Right before we left our country, we waited for the new year to come, but our new year opened with war and the sound of bombs, not with balloons. That night, we had no dinner, only tears. We come here to Europe because we hope to give our children a good life and a future. We want to wake up to the sound of clocks, not bombs. We want to sleep without fear. We want to hear only the sounds of our family's laughter. We sold our home and everything we owned. Now we do not have anything. I hope one day we can find someone who loves and supports us, who will talk with us, not hate us. Refugees are not bad people. Please stop hating us. Just put yourself in our place. How would you feel if you were insulted every day on the bus? Would you be patient? If you look, you will see we are like you. Some people see refugees as homeless, nameless, unclean, uneducated, and criminal. Yes, we are homeless, but not hopeless. We are nameless, but not weak. If we are unclean, it's because we slept in the forest, streets, and tents, but we have clean hearts. If our crime is speaking up for our rights and freedom, yes, we are criminals. If you do not want to see any refugees or migrants, fine. But please do not insult us. Sometimes only one word or action from you can make us feel as if our whole life is a jail. My mom always tells me, just calling someone a donkey does not make them a donkey. Calling us bad and unclean does not make us bad and unclean. Being a refugee means you are strong. You pass through a difficult, dangerous journey, and still you are alive. You have hope. You have goals and dreams. As my mom also says, when you find yourself in a bad situation, just remember this. After every dark night, a beautiful morning will come.
Beautiful, beautiful. Thank you. Thank you for that excerpt. There's so many rich stories in this beautiful book. I'd like to open it up now to those who have joined us. Particular questions or comments or thoughts you'd like to share, reflections on the presentation. We welcome you to unmute, raise your hand. We'll recognize you. Well, perhaps people are thinking. I have a question, if you don't mind. Helen, it seems like your first interest in going to Greece was to do research for the novel. I'm curious what led you to consider taking on this subject in novel form. What drew you to the subject to begin with?
Yeah. Well, in brief, kind of a long story, I'll try and make it quick. It all really started with the Iraq War. And when we invaded Iraq in 2003 with no justification whatsoever, I was so horrified, you know. And then, of course, that rode on the back of all the anti-Muslims sentiment that came up after 9/11. And I just kept thinking about how Jewish refugees had been rejected. after World War, during and just after World War II, and been rejected by the UK and the USA and sent back to their deaths. And that we created the 1951 Geneva Refugee Convention so that to ensure that refugees would never be treated like that again. And I felt like, look what's happening, we're doing it again, we're breaking that sacred promise. And it really, really upset me. So I realized that I'd been writing a lot about Iraqis, and I'd gotten to know quite a few of them here in the States who had been able to come over here as refugees. And I had been very touched by them for many reasons. And I realized that a lot of Iraqis had fled to Damascus and elsewhere in Syria when they left our war. And now, and then after 2011, when the Syrian revolution came out and turned into a civil war, they had to flee again. So I originally thought I would go to Greece. I'd been to that area before a long time ago. I knew it. And see if I could find Iraqis who'd been doubly displaced. I didn't find that anybody with that particular story, but I found Iyad, who's Syrian, and I sort of fell in with people from other countries. I did meet some Iraqis, but they weren't doubly displaced. But anyway, that's how I got into the sort of subject of refugees in the first place. But I've been writing about war for years and years already by then, and the aftermath of war. So, of course, it has its victims on all sides. I mean, war spares nobody. So it's the greatest horror we commit, that and killing the planet as human beings. And I just feel that we have to push back against this terrible prejudice that all authoritarian governments feed off on and pump up so that they can grab power.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, very, very powerful testimony there yourself. I do want to share another question from someone in the group who asks, and I know you touch on this in the book, how many of the individuals whose lives are documented in the book actually receive asylum in Europe? You have information about what percentage of refugees actually receive asylum. Can you address that, either of you?
Well, I'll say it depends where you're from. So certain nationalities are much more likely to get asylum than others. It also depends on kind of what's happening at the moment. So, you know, when the Taliban took over in Afghanistan, when Syrians first started to flee out of Syria, they had a very high rate of acceptance. Then the same thing happened at first after the Taliban took over last summer in Afghanistan. And now it's happening with Ukrainians, although Ukrainians are getting much better treatment than anybody else ever got, including in Greece. But so there's a kind of almost like fashions of refugees, I hate to say it, where some will get more asylum than others. But globally, only 2% of refugees globally are able to actually find stable, productive, you know, lives, which is heartbreakingly small.
Yeah, I was really struck by that statistic when I came upon that in the book. I must say it was quite shocking.
Also, we could just talk about how under the new government in Greece, getting asylum is hardly the end of your problems. You want to talk about that a little bit yet?
Yeah, like
experienced it.
Under the new rules of the new government now, like when you are recognized as a refugee, that means you have to leave the house you are living in, and you will be cut out of the money assistance. And you will find yourself like homeless.
Yeah.
And the crazy thing about there is that they don't do something to integrate you inside the society. We have written and we have said many things about this in the book. Like, imagine if you don't speak the language and if you are in a country the people themselves, like the local people, cannot find jobs. What are you going to do?
There's no, so what other countries offer, you know, although again, other countries offer more integration. But when the Ukrainians arrived in Greece, by the way, in April, last April, more Ukrainians arrived in Greece in one go than had than all refugee, all asylum seekers had arrived in the whole of the year before. They were immediately given temporary protected status. They were given housing, they were put in schools, job training, and English lessons, none of which have been offered to anybody else by Greece. Not, you know, when this is not to say Ukrainians shouldn't get those things, it's to say that everybody should get those things, because that's the right way to treat refugees.
So are there
Mary Ann,
any, yeah, Ken, I think Ken wanted to say
oh
something.
no, sure. That's right. I just first of all, yet I'd like to say my salamat. أنا يا أخي أنا كنت في الشام، أنا درست في جامعة الشام من زمان، فسلام عليك، أنا مزبوط كثير أشوفك. هذا من جيل وجيلين أنا قبل منك. I studied at the University of Damascus. I'm really very happy to see
Yeah,
a
because
brother of
we
mine. I was, of course, at the, probably about your grandfather's generation, but still, I love Damascus, and I'm so sad about what's happened to Syria. And what I wanted to emphasize, first of all, I wanted to ask a question. And yet, you're obviously not in Greece, you're in Reykjavik. And I'm curious,
Yes.
what is your story? How did you end up there? And what happened to your family, your brothers, your.
So everything happened like by chance. One day, my father was like walking in Athens and he met a friend, and his friend has a friend who is living in Reykjavik. And he told him, like, I think since you have like a lot of children, I have a lot of siblings, by the way. Yeah, like I'm sure that Iceland would be really good country for your children, so they can attend schools and do something about their future. So they came to Iceland. By then I was with my two brothers in Greece, and we stayed there like for 4 years. So they were not in Iceland before us. My
Because,
family.
right, because you and your brothers were over 21, and so you had to be, you weren't treated as part of the family. You each were treated as an independent adult and had to go through the asylum system
Exactly.
as if you didn't had no connection to your family.
Even like when I made a request to join my family in Athens, do you know what they have done? They just send me to another camp in the north of Thessaloniki, where I need to take the train to see my family for 6 hours.
So who's in Reykjavik with you? Is the whole family in Iceland now, or?
Yes, we
Oh,
all in Reykjavik now.
alhamdulillah,
Shukran kteer lelek.
zaman في العالم العربي. Yeah.
وين عشت؟
في الشام أنا كنت في الوحدة الأولى في الجامعة، يعني تعرف الجامعة؟
جامعة دمشق.
دمشق، وكنت في تونس ومصر والسعودية وكل العالم.
اللهجة تونسية تقريبا.
تونسية بالضبط، عندي نطق تونسي، صح. He noticed I have a Tunisian accent, which even the Syrians, after living in
Wow.
Syria, would understand.
Wow. Great.
His Arabic is amazing.
Yeah.
I know. I'm so glad Ken, you could join us tonight. Thank you.
Well, Helen
Catherine,
said, so, can I just add something that, to what Helen
please.
said? Because Helen, first of all, I'm very impressed by what you're saying. And I think we all know the reason the Ukrainians were welcome is because they're white and Christian. I
Yeah.
believe that's, you didn't say it, but we know that. Something that I'm as passionate as you are on this issue. And people in this country are so blind to the horrific impacts on our war in the Middle East, including in refugees. And I'll just give you one example. Brexit was a disaster for the United Kingdom by so many measures, and most British now regret it, 55%. But Brexit happened, if you look at the reasons for it, was fear of Middle East refugees. That was the number one cause.
You bet.
You know, and that these stupid wars, the weaponry, and I think the Syrian revolution was also an indirect result of the destabilization of Iraq. I was in Damascus just before things fell apart, and all the Sunni who were flooding into Syria were a very big reason for the destabilization. Americans don't make the connection because we're not told. We're not told. how our weaponization of the Middle East has created this refugee crisis, which is destabilizing Europe.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know how to
say it in Iraq. It's, yeah, we triggered a bomb.
Yes.
By invading Iraq. Yes, and look what's happening in the UK now. They're trying to, you know, round up Syrians and Iraqis and Afghans and Africans and, and send them to Rwanda.
Like, it is stupidity, to be honest. It's just like the money you are going to spend sending people away from your country. You can use this money to integrate them and make them valuable.
Yeah.
The
new British Prime Minister just offered France $74 million to hire more border patrol cops along the beach to arrest refugees and smugglers to stop them crossing the channel in boats. I mean, 74 million could go a long way towards helping people get legal help and humanitarian help and for seeking asylum without putting a burden on, without risking their lives at sea. And you can deprive smugglers of their customers that way without, you know, without it being so draconian. But of course, they're not arresting the pilots of airplanes or who are delivering Ukrainians. So the racism and Christian centered prejudice is undeniable behind all this.
No, and it's worldwide. Indeed. And it's something that and that's why it's so important that you did what you did, that you told the stories, that you have the book out there, that you can push back and share this with people around the globe. And we will do what we can here to share those stories as far and wide as possible. Because in America, we, as Ken mentioned, there's not as much information about what is happening in Syria, in Turkey, in Greece, as there is, you know, with our own border crisis in Central America.
I do think I would also like to point out, though, that there's a connection between this country and that country, because it all got a lot worse after Trump was elected.
Yeah.
When Trump was elected on his anti-immigrant and anti-Muslim platform, it kind of enabled a lot of other people to get much more vocal and overt about what was happening there. It's no coincidence that the EU-Turkey deal happened in 2016.
Right.
So, or that we've got this right-wing prime minister now in Italy and, you know, Sweden, all these people saying the exact same things that he says. So it used to be something we kept a little more under wraps, and unless we were overtly authoritarian, as in, you know, Hungary or Poland, but now it's not even kept under wraps. And it's especially shameful when it comes out of the UK and the US, because they were so important to that original Geneva deal, and it's such a betrayal of what we're supposed to stand for in the West.
Right.
No question.
Another question. Catherine, did you have a question, or someone else have a question before we conclude?
I'll just say I dropped in the chat for those of you who would like a copy of the book, you know, come on by the store, or you can contact us via the email or the website there. And so we can share this. It's a great gift to friends that you have in your circles to spread the word about what's going on. So we hope you'll stop in and grab a copy.
Thanks. And if anybody has a book group they'd be interested in having us talk to, we'd love to do that too.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
Thank you, Helen.
Thank you so much. And how exciting to have you with us. It was a first to have an Arabic speaker for us anyway.
Well, it's so important. I mean, if it helps to you, one of the things we always ask is, what can we do? You know, that's the question. What can we do, except other than getting depressed?
Yeah.
And at least here in Sag Harbor, one of the things that after, for example, Trump's horrible anti-Muslim rampage, we started having an annual iftar here at Ramadan, which in the last several years has now grown into an Islamic center of the Hamptons. And there was an interfaith service for Thanksgiving a few days ago where an imam came. So there are people who want to build the bridges. There are people who want to build the bridges, and they will be the people who read your book. Hopefully some of the others will too.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, it's to leave on that note.
Yeah, and as we said, our last chapter is all about what we can do.
Good.
Yeah, both as individuals and as, you know, in a larger sense too, and as countries.
Yeah, that's it's a wonderful resource, that the chapter there. But again, I just to emphasize, you know, beyond the statistics, there's the human story, the human struggle. You touch our hearts. You move us with this book and the story of these human lives. And, you know, for me, that's the center of it. We're so indebted to both of you for